Hey, it's Emily, the host and creator of the Modern Romantic Podcast. I just wanted to let you know of something you may not be aware of, and that is we sometimes reference the chat or an audience during our show, and that's because we record via a live stream. So we actually have a live show on Mondays and the occasional Sunday, and you can tune in too and be part of that live audience. It is via chat through our social media network. So when we're streaming live on Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, Instagram, and YouTube, you can join in the chat and we can see it. And so can our guest, and we can answer your questions and respond to your comments and see everything. You can be part of that community. We'd love for you to be there. So join us sometime. Head to our website to check out our social media links and when we're streaming live. That is www.themodrom.com.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Romantic Podcast, where we celebrate and inspire romanticism through passionate people doing incredible things. Hi, I'm auditioning for the role of co-host number three. Hi, I'm Trey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Emily. Hi, Emily.
Hi, I don't know what number I am as far as co-hosts go, but I want to know who number one and two are if you're number three.
That's the thing with like auditions, they don't ever let you say your name. They just give you a number and you just walk in and be like, hi, I'm auditioning for this person.
Hi, I'm number 27. Okay, well, I don't know. I think I'm okay with being number one.
Okay.
I'll wear the crown.
And you wear it well.
I'll take one for the team.
Thank you. Well, with reference to that, I really want to dive into our guest this evening. So would you do the honors of introducing our fabulously funny guest here today?
Absolutely. Welcome to the podcast, the incredible Susan Berger. From Broadway to the silver screen, Susan's journey in acting is extraordinary. And she's going to share with us her experiences, stories, and a little bit of her world from entertainment and writing. Welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. This is so exciting for us.
Believe me, being asked to be on a podcast about books is the dream of a lifetime.
Well, welcome. We're so glad to have you. You're multi-talented. You're multifaceted. And so you are, I mean, we know you as an actress because you were in so many things, Broadway, off-Broadway, and also television. And then you're also a writer. And what else? You make like a mean casserole or something too, right?
I babysit well.
Okay.
My grandsons were over this weekend. I just got back from Vancouver where I was shooting a commercial. And my son immediately called me and said, will you watch them so we can go to a movie and you can have them make the birthday cake? Aww. One is three. He made the birthday cake while the eight-year-old read the recipe.
Oh,
I was tired.
Now, the question is, how did they do? How was the final product?
Yeah, came out well.
Oh, good.
I'm sure you had some supervision in there.
Especially the frosting. That was really good. Ooh. We used fudge.
Mm. What kind?
There's a microwave fudge recipe that's really easy. And we made it vegan because their dad is vegan. Okay. And tastes just the same and just as good. So.
Oh, good. And so it was his birthday?
It was my grandson Walter's eighth birthday. And in the past, he's made his own cake. But this year, he elected to read the recipe to us. So, all right.
He promoted himself to...
Yes, he promoted himself to head reader.
What a cool idea, like make it for your own and then at some point you start directing others of how you want your cake to be made.
Oh, he's very into that now. Yes, he put a lot of eyes on it. He got a 7 and then he put 2 candles in front of it to cross out 7 and then put an 8.
I love that. So with you being so like multifaceted and apparently an incredible Oh, I completely lost the word, which is terrible for me.
Probably grandmother.
That yes. So, and an incredible grandmother. How did you make the transition between all of these different facets of being being an actor, being on Broadway, going to television, and then into writing? How did you make such transitions between these different art forms?
Well, it's a long adventure. And I started out in acting, which is what I wanted to do more than anything. Went to England thinking, oh boy, I can be an actor there. I'd just gotten my master's at the University of Hawaii, and I flew from there to England. Got there, realized, oh, I'm here. What is the name of a theater? Better still, what is the name of a hotel? I really knew nothing. And as it turned out, they have an extremely strict labor policy. And while I did get hired, I couldn't have it because they take 6 weeks to check it out to see if anybody else in the British Commonwealth or any American married to a British citizen can do the role. So basically you're out.
Oh.
And after that, I went back, went to New York, got lucky at some point, did some, was married to a fellow actor, and he wanted to come out here. And I said, no, you can't, because I was going back to do a Broadway musical. I go with you, you have to come with me. So we went out, made it here in 77, and he got lucky in 79 and got a role in Urban Cowboy. And he played John Travolta's uncle. And after that, his career just took off. So at the same time, I had my first child, and I decided that the world didn't need me enough, that I should turn my kids over to somebody else. So I took a break for 15 years while they were growing up. And then I started back, and I started in improv, because if you leave it for 15 years, nobody believes you can do it.
Mm.
And so casting directors would see me and they say, well, you're really good, but they're not sure you can do it. So I did a 7-year stretch of nothing but improv. And then I got lucky and got some plays and then more improv. And my son, who is also an actor, got me a manager. And that manager, Entertainment Lab, made my career take off.
Awesome.
So there's a point to having children.
Well, love this.
Well, I wasn't going to do it. Who wants kids? It turned out they were really, it's a good thing.
So, like, what was it when you say that your career really took off? What was like one of the roles that you had that like really was one of those, oh my gosh, my life is changing moments?
Well, the biggest one, of course, is Jury Duty. I have done lots of television and film, and I was very lucky in 2020 to be cast in Joel Coen's Tragedy of Macbeth with Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand. And that was magical. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Jury Duty is different. It was an improv audition. You had to write, you had to do two monologues. Mm-hmm. And normally you get lines and you say them. But this one, they wanted improv. And I didn't think I could do it.
Even though you had a history of improv.
Right, but I hadn't done it in a while. And okay. My son Chris stayed in it and I went to UCB too. And I went to their musical theater thing, but he was in it much longer. And here's the deal. I am, you may have noticed, chronologically gifted. Nobody wants me on their improv team because it's like being on a team with a child or a dog. I get all the attention. They say, oh, look at her. She still talks. Oh my God, that is so cute. And when I, other than doing classes, the only person I'm on a team with is my son, who will not call me grandma or mom and does improv the way it's supposed to be done. But when this audition came in and they said, we just want two improv speeches, I thought, well, I had an idea, but it wasn't a great one. And my son looked at me and said, no. And he handed me a motorcycle vest and said, put this on. You came to Los Angeles in the 80s with your all-girl band and you broke up over drugs. And now you're working at a motorcycle bar bartending, but they all respect you. I mean, that was a great idea. And then he said, for the next one, you are the manager of a restaurant in a strip mall in Chatsworth, which is a very tiny part of the valley. And if you leave to go jury duty, the whole thing will fall apart. So those were great ideas, and I had a lot of fun with it.
That's a way to go.
I occasionally got recognized for, you know, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Two Broke Girls or Brooklyn Nine-Nine or some of those. But most of the time, and nobody goes up to me and says, hello, you were so great in American Horror Story. I totally loved you.
I was going there next, but that was something Trey said to me before the show. He was like, oh, it's her. What did you say, Trey?
You knew me?
Those were some of my favorite scenes when you came on, because I was honestly legitimately terrified. That was such an incredible performance.
It was honestly legitimately terrifying to do it, because what the audience did not see on, I think it was this episode 108 or something, is we dragged these kids, put stakes through them, and then set them on fire. And the shot they chose to use was an overhead shot. We did that 7 times or 8 times, and we were right in front of it.
Wow.
As they set them on fire. And the whole crew was, you know, we had people by and they had masks and stuff like that, but it was still absolutely a PTSD moment.
Sure.
I can imagine, but still, that was my oh my god, that's her moments of like, and she's gonna be on the show, yes,
but I won't do that kind of thing.
Perfect.
Well, my night's made.
Crazy. I couldn't watch it. I'm not a horror fan.
Yeah.
And the weirdest thing is, when I was here in 1969, my friend dragged me to a seer who was going to tell my fortune. And she said my future was in horror films. And did I have a thing for Vincent Price?
Wow. No. Like a thing or a thing? Like,
you know, like a thing for Vincent Price. Well, I've met him, but no. And I thought, that's the weirdest thing ever, because I would never ever choose to do a horror film.
Right. Wow.
For me, American Horror Story was like at my limit of things, and even sometimes there were just episodes that I couldn't, but I don't know what it was.
Really scary, and I couldn't watch it at all. I couldn't. Somebody had to find where I was on it and tell me, and then I told somebody to tape it for me. And then the weird thing is, Christopher, my son, Christopher Corbin, and I both did the one about Nazi hunters. It's on HBO with Al Pacino.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm in the first episode of season one. I figured, well, it's, you know, scary. But it wasn't scary, not my scene. It was just, I was a survivor, and I was pointing the finger at somebody, and I had a Czechoslovakian accent. It was nothing scary about it. And then at the beginning of that episode, when I sat down to watch it, they did the worst thing. They stabbed out somebody's eyes and put them in a butter statue. And I thought, I cannot. So when we got to my son's episode, he was in episode 6, I think, and he was a Nazi. And I said, you cue it up. I am not watching another in a minute of this. And his was scary. But not as scary as that first scene in season one. That was just, wow. I don't like things with eyes, ever.
Yeah. But I think after watching that and then getting the reprieve of like being recognized with some more comedic performances in My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and then especially with Jury Duty, can you talk to us a little bit about what it's been like to be filming for that and what your kind of preparation is for that kind of show?
There, we had no idea what it was. It was advertised, the auditions were as an untitled legal drama. And after I was doing it, I spent a year trying to explain to people what we had done.
Yeah.
And going in, I was fairly scared because I had no idea what we were going to do and what we were supposed to do. But as it turns out, Jury Duty is a very tightly plotted show. But there were no words. The words are ours.
Yeah, I love that.
And what I love is that you had 14, as many as 14 and 15 people in a room doing an improvisation with a guy who did not know we were actors. And at no time was there any over talking. And if you've ever seen improv, normally if you get a bunch of people together, there's over talking, and there wasn't. But it's because we had goals.
Yeah.
There were things that were supposed to happen. And then some things were just magic. For those of you who don't know the show, it is a comedy kind of what is it?
It's kind of like a reality show, but it's not a reality show 'cause it's you can't say it's scripted really,
No,
but it
it's a
is planned.
documentary comedy on jury duty. And the
Yeah.
guy who is our hero, a whole bunch of people applied to be in a documentary about jury duty. There was an
Yeah.
ad on Craigslist and everything. And Alexis Sampietro, one of the line producers, went through and did the questions. And they were, she interviewed over 1,500 people. And out of that, chose three or four that could maybe do this. And some of us were supposed to have come from that thing, that we weren't all just jury duty people that came in. Some of us came in to try to be on the jury because we knew we'd get paid to be in this documentary. And the pay was 400 a day. And so people wanted to do it.
Sure.
And so the. It starts out for everybody in the room where they take you when you have to apply for jury duty. And things happened in there. And it happens that there is one guy in there that's a celebrity, truly James Marsden, who's been called in for jury duty, who does not want to be on jury duty. It was so from there, they got selected. And during this whole process, Ronald Gladden, who was the star, he was a 29-year-old contractor who just sold his solar contract business and was looking for something interesting while he went to another job, which happened to be manager of a Home Depot. But the minute he got on the set with us, the thing is, we all fell in love with him. There were lots of cam because we were doing a documentary, there were always cameras.
Yeah.
And at the end of every day of filming, Alexis and Jordan Cohen would take us into a room, and you see some of this on jury duty. You don't see them, but you see them asking us questions about what happened today and what we thought about it. And it was really interesting because the one thing is we needed to stay in character because he couldn't find out we weren't what we said we were.
Right.
And at the in episode seven, by the way, there are eight episodes. And at the end of episode seven, after the deliberation, the judge tells Ronald he has not been in what he thinks he has been in, but he's been on a hero's journey. And then on episode eight, we show him how we did it.
Yeah, that
And
was the
camera,
payoff.
writers' rooms, and there were the regular cameras and then there were the hidden cameras. And then when there were things like there was a scene in the restaurant Margaritaville, all cameras were hidden. And everybody in that restaurant, waiters, everybody was an actor. There was nobody in there that they couldn't control. And it was a pretty amazing thing to do.
What a production. Yeah.
Wow. The thing is, we finished it, I think, in April of 2022, and they did not release it till April of 2023. And none of us had any idea what was going to happen with it. And they did a little, you know, red carpet screening for us all. And we saw the first three episodes at the Culver Theater in Culver City. And at the end of it, the director stood up and said, you know, well, we can be proud of what we did, but nobody knew if it was going to be anything anybody'd like.
Right.
And then one of our writers, Carrie O'Neill, who is also a wonderful improvist, put on TikTok, I just Truman Showed a Man. And it took off. And it went crazy. And it's been crazy ever since. And I can go to the grocery store and have people stop me. This has awesome. Never happened before.
Wow. Well, hopefully the people that stop you say excellent things to you.
We all, everybody says nice things and they like the show. And the thing is, one of the things that you come away with is, yes, hope and belief in your fellow humans, because Ronald's got to be one of the nicest guys I've ever met. And mostly what happens in this show is kindness.
Yeah.
And somebody said we out-lassoed Ted Lasso. I don't think so, because that's one of my favorite shows. That. And we're nominated, which is amazing. And we're about to do screenings for the Screen Actors Guild Awards. And then maybe for the Golden Globes. We are not Oscar material. They don't do TV shows.
Right. So it's just not.
But it's been good for my writing because all of a sudden I could put on TikTok, hey, I'm also a writer. And I write romance, time travel romance with older heroines. And people look at it. And it's been an adventure. I have two novels I haven't published yet. Jennifer Cruzy, who you had on the show, is one of my favorite authors, and I follow her blog religiously. And
she has.
Oh, girl, wants to. It's under Susan B. James, and the first one is Time and Forever, and it won best. It was nominated for best first book, and nominated for best time travel. The second one, which I got the rights back from the publisher. Just got him back and republished on Amazon, is called Maybe This Time. And that won Best Contemporary in 2019, and it won Best Time Travel, and it won for audiobook. It came in second for Best Audiobook.
Nice.
And they're all available, by the way, I have to tell you this, is audiobooks in your library for free. I haven't figured out how to get the other ones in, but when I was publishing, self-publishing Maybe This Time, they wanted suggestions for the cover and they wanted symbols, and I thought, I don't remember, and I borrowed my own book from the library because so I don't generally have audiobooks, and I really liked it. It was a good book. I was very happy with it. So then I went and got the third one, Irish Magic, and listened to that. I have to go back and listen to the first one, Time and Forever, which is about two women in their 60s who accidentally time travel to 1969. Hmm. And one finds an old love and one finds a new love. But the thing is, time travel has rules. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? And, thank you. Somebody said, excuse me while I go buy these books. Yeah. I have two more that I need to either send out or self-publish. And the first one is called Lord Byron's Daughter and speculative fiction about Ada Lovelace. And if you are a computer person, you may know who that is. Ada Lovelace was Lord Byron's daughter. He, the mad, bad villain of the Regency. And she had a very interesting education. And she got with a person who decided he could invent a machine that could think. And she said it can do more than that. And she wrote the first computer algorithm in 1824.
Wow.
First our war department named the first computer language after her, Ada. And I thought, wow. And you know, when they did that movie The Imitation Game. Alan Turing used her work. And I thought, wouldn't that be fun if she time traveled? So in my book, she time travels to 1941 and World War II, and actually does meet Alan Turing, but cool. And other things happen in the book. The next one is called The Witch's Garden, and it is a rom-com with a woman who was a canceled TV star like Ellen with a big talk show, who got canceled, goes back to Vermont to the house her grams left her, and finds out her grams left her more than a house. There are a bunch of magical instruments and recipes, and somebody expects her to use them. And there's the race to apparently there are other witches in town and they're looking for the stuff. And there's a cat, of course.
Of course.
And her worst enemy from when she was there as a child is now turned into a vet and seems to be a nice person. And also her daughter, who hadn't spoken to her in 20 years, has come back with a child. So it's fun.
Wow.
Okay, these are some twists and turns.
Yeah.
I love these plots. I really want to read the one about Ada Lovelace meeting Alan Turing. That sounds incredible. I will be picking up.
I'm happy to give you a PDF of it. I have got to decide whether... What I was wondering is, I do know that like Soulmate Publishing would publish it for me. I know that. But I was going to try to get an agent and see if I could go a little more mainstream because of Jury Duty.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that can happen. I've sent it out to one more agent. And if it doesn't, I'm going to self-publish. It's been edited. I would never, ever put out a book that wasn't edited by somebody else, because I've seen books that have not been edited. And I'm not... The only person I know who's really good at it is a woman named Sarah Wynde, W-Y-N-D-E. And she's a wonderful author, and she's got a series about ghosts. And I asked her, and I have a blog and I interviewed people, how she did it. But she used to be an editor. And among other things, she reads the entire book backwards to herself. I could never do that.
We both did the same thing. Yeah. Honestly, we have Kaz in our chat said, please, 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 if anything, get into book talk side of TikTok and your books will fly off the shelves. I don't know if you're aware of the power of book talk.
I am aware of, I'm on TikTok, and that was all because of Jury Duty. But I did put on my TikTok, which I think is under Susan James Berger, my TikTok. I'd have to look.
Okay.
And, a funny story about that. I have heard of TikTok, but I was never going to do anything. And Jury Duty took off. And some of us from the cast were at a women's film festival to see a movie. And they said, oh, you have to be on TikTok. And I said, I have no idea how. And they said, we'll show you. And so they took my phone and I held it landscape, which you can't do on TikTok.
No.
They didn't tell me that you should. Thank you. Well, I was saying, as far as TikTok was concerned, somebody had said, you need to get on Book Talk. And I'm not sure I did by doing the TikTok, but I hashtagged Book Talk when I did the Liz Danger review.
I think that's one of the fun things about TikTok is there's no real wrong way outside of like the landscape versus the vertical thing. There's no real wrong way to TikTok.
Well, no, it's getting people to watch it. I know it had about 8,000 views. I have one that we knitted with somebody else that has 1.5 million views. But most of mine end up being about, less. Some are like 50,000 and some are a lot less.
Wow.
That's going to take off, though. I mean, I feel like what you're going to see is nothing but growth. So I think, especially
I
when you start,
it would be a flash in the pan.
When you start doing like hashtag book talk on your videos, when you're talking about books, that's, I posted one video on my personal account that was, because I'm a new beekeeper, and I did not realize that bee talk was a thing, and I just used the hashtag bee talk because I thought it was cute. And that video, the first one I did, blew up, and I had no idea. So you never know. I think, at least from our posts, I see a lot more response to posts that we have the hashtag book talk than we do for other posts. So,
oh, okay. I was thinking what I'm going to do is, as soon as I figure out how, I've done a thing. I made pages of my novel. And if I can figure out how to read, this is my great American novel.
Yes.
Log.
So Log.
Yeah.
It's called Log, or that's
yes,
the Log?
It's called okay. Log. It's Ooh. Called Log.
Log.
And then, yes, a two-year-old can read this, except for in a very unfortunate tendency to pronounce the word hog pig. Log, on log. See, this
okay.
is frog.
Frog. Aww. I love it.
Oh, that's cute. Frog.
Hog.
Hog. Look at that little tail.
I finally decided not that the hog.
Did you illustrate as well?
Frog. And yeah, I figured after I wrote this, I wrote it in a creativity class. Who's the person who wrote the book on A Spiritual Guide to Recovery and Creativity? And I've just lost her name. But it's Julia Cameron, okay. who used to be married to Martin Scorsese at one point. But she wrote a wonderful book. And I used it, my sister used it, and I went to a class on it, and people were doing art and stuff, and I thought, I could write a book. And so I wrote the book, and since it was only 67 words long, I figured the only way that people would understand it is if I illustrated it. And my mother and my sister are wonderful artists. I don't feel I have a lot of talent there. But I thought, well, I could draw one hog, one dog, one log, one frog, one bog, and then move them around on the page and scan them. So that's what I did.
I love it.
That's so cool.
I love that you found a way anyway. That to me is, that's great. And that you know, some people would just be like, oh, I don't draw, and then not do anything. So good for you. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I have a bunch of children's books I have not sold. Well, two of them I did. I had a publisher for children's books, Guardian Angel Publishing. In my life, I have worked for Miracle Films, Guardian Angel, Soulmate. There's one I'm missing here. But all of the names had like interesting connotations.
Right.
Anyway, Guardian Angel picked up my first book, which my son Christopher and I wrote together when he was 10.
Oh.
And it was published when he was 25. I did not illustrate any of the books that were published. Then I did a nonfiction book called Earthquake for kids on what it's like and what you should do. And then I did one When I Grow Up and Mom, Is There a Santa Claus? And then they took two more of my books. Sunday Cat, which is about a cat that does nothing but snooze. And Ella, my sister Ella, about an autistic child from the Sims point of view. And they bought both of those and then they went broke. So those two never got published. And of course, the others are mostly not available, but I went ahead and bought the art for Mom, Is There a Santa? And it currently is available as a Kindle book.
Hmm.
Okay.
I published the picture book itself with Ingram Sparks, and that turned out to be a really terrible experience.
Oh, no.
So I had all the art, and I had the original. The publisher gave me the original thing. For some reason, not in the, you know, they send you a picture of what they're going to do. And there was an extra page at the back. when they published it, there were two extra pages at the back, so four blank pages. So people kept returning it.
Oh.
And I objected and I said, you did this wrong. And instead of which they billed me for all the books that were returned, having never paid me for any of them in the first place. I kept my price low and apparently their price went up for printing. And they failed to tell me that they would use the new printing price. And so I made no money and they gave me back all these books with four blank pages. So everybody figures
something's missing.
Right. So I may do that again with somebody else.
Sure.
But in the meantime, it's on Kindle because it was a cute book. And Casey Snyder, the illustrator, is just lovely.
Hey, it's Trey here from the Modern Romantic Podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you so, so much for listening. Wherever you are listening from, it really means the world to us. Emily and I started this podcast to share inspiring stories and celebrate the many forms that art can take. Having you here along for the ride as we continue that mission really inspires us to keep going. We are constantly blown away by every single listen, so we really mean it. Thank you. Okay, now get back to the interview. This one's good. Okay, Susan, this is another one of those coincidence moments of that was you. And I didn't realize that until now. My mom and I actually picked up Mom, Is There a Santa? Like after it was published. And we bought that book. And it is sitting at her house right now.
Aww.
Wait.
That's awesome.
I'll just pull a copy.
I love it.
Because I recognize, like, that name.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
Oh my gosh.
Mom will go and, like, look at different books and things that have been published, like, specifically children's books, because I've got a very young nephew. And so, like, we saw it, and she loves Santa Claus in general. And so she picked that up, and she's like, oh my God, like, what a cool concept. And so she has it somewhere at her house right now.
That is so sweet.
That's amazing. I love it.
Well, I have copies to give away if you don't mind four blank pages at the end.
I would be happy with four blank pages at the end.
This is one of the originals. Yeah, it is. Without the four blank pages, but I have a bunch of those.
So, like, your copy at your mom's house has four blank pages in it?
I don't know.
She probably got the one that was, it was published with Guardian Angel. And when their company went broke, they took them off Amazon and off Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
They were available everywhere. But my only choice was to either sell it to somebody else. And since I wasn't the illustrator, the idea seemed to be better to buy the art and just self-publish it.
Sure.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, it's a small world after all. I love moments like these.
That's so wonderful.
Oh, my God.
When you're writing about time travel, what are some things that you have to consider that maybe you have to keep your stories?
Any rule you want on how it's done. But once you've made the rule, you can't break it.
Uh-huh.
And once you've set up your parameters and this is how it happened. For instance, in my first book, it was a virtual reality experience that got too real and went wrong. And took them actually back in time. And then it was turned out that that's what the machine did. It translated virtual reality into real time. And it worked as a concept. And at the end, everybody said, oh, that really worked. And the second one had to do with the same virtual reality machine. And then the Lord Byron's daughter, it's a formula in an ancient Cyrillic book. It has to be read alive. Time is a river. And if you read this in the right order with three people, you can go back in time.
So you've made
it. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as you stick to the rules, which if any of you are Marvel fans.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, that one episode where Captain America turned up. No, they broke their own rule. And my older son, who is a bigger Marvel fan than I am, keeps explaining to me that no, they did not break their own rule. Yes, they did. They clearly stated that you couldn't go back that or forward and whatever it was. They made a rule. And then at the end of that last movie in the series,
okay.
Who's the villain, the guy with the glove?
Thanos.
Yeah. In that series with Thanos, they made a rule about time travel and then broke it with the last movie in the series where they had Captain America coming forward.
I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember it now, but I remember being in the theater absolutely furious that they had broken their own rule.
Sure.
Because it's the one deal. Make your rules and then stick to them.
Right. Yeah, no, people catch that.
No exceptions.
There is, I have a coworker that I think that you and she would just get along with fabulously. We were talking about Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she had a 20-minute rant about her issues with that movie. And was she wrong? No, she was 100% right about the things in that. But she was so passionate about, like, and what about this continuation and this from this movie and this and this isn't. And after all of that rant, I just went, "You're a Marvel fan?" And like, yes. And then proceeded to just talk about like these Marvel films and was able to connect the dots between these things and point out like very, very, very big plot holes. So your curiosity with that is well justified.
Oh, there.
Josh said, there you go, talking about your own movie again, Trey.
Look, I'm sorry. I've got to get my royalties where I can, okay?
We think he's Doctor Strange.
Well.
We know he's Doctor Strange.
It's nice to meet you. I'm very fond of your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
He's just a lot like Benedict Cumberbatch, where he's tall, he's got the voice. If you put a red cape on him, he can do all the same things.
Who also played the something game, the one I was talking about. He played Alan Turing.
Oh, the Imitation Game.
Oh yeah,
he's a wonderful actor.
This just went full circle.
Yeah,
I love it. Can you time travel, Trey?
There are rules.
Did Susan make them up?
No, they're. I declined to call
it. It is real science. Like they have decided scientifically that you could probably travel forward.
Oh, forward, not backward.
But not backward, because if you're traveling backwards, there are all the rules. If you you can't go back and kill yourself, you can't meet people. You can't change history. If you change history, you're splitting off and becoming an alternate universe. Sometimes you can get away in some books with changing your personal history in such a way that would not affect major history.
I feel like
there are all kinds of rules about it and, you know, discussions about what makes good travel.
Emily, I think Jacob, someone Frank? We used to work with, actually had a lot of theories on that. And we got into a very heated debate about this very topic in the store one day amongst selling suits of all things and having this philosophical discussion of, would this cause an internet or
a glitch in the time continuum.
Thank you. Words are failing me today. But yes, like, would this cause a paradox? What would happen here? And we got very heated about this.
I could see this conversation happening. Definitely. Yeah,
and the thing is, there are different writers who think different things about it. I love Robert Heinlein's ideas. I love a lot of people's ideas and time travel.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter as long as they don't break their own rules.
Right.
If you make it logical, if you can make it so your readers can believe it, then you've done good time travel.
Yeah. Like, I remember Michael Crichton writing Time Travel, and it was the book where they went back to, like, medieval times. For the life of me, I can't remember the name of the book, which is terrible because I read it and saw they made a movie out of it. And it was sad because the movie could have been better. And
yeah,
forgive me for saying so. But because I thought the book was fabulous and I couldn't wait for it to be a movie. And he went into the whole quantum physics thing. And so, you know, Michael Crichton writes where, like, the first chapter is intro and the second chapter is like, we're going to explain the science behind why the rest of the book is feasible. And then the rest of the book. Yeah. And so then you're like set up for the rest of the book can feel like truth, whether it is or not. But I think he did a pretty good job of explaining it using quantum physics. But I imagine as a writer, then he had to go learn
quantum physics. I've done some quantum physics. I'm not an expert at all, but I've read some.
Okay.
And I find it fascinating.
Yeah. It was kind of mind-blowing at the time because I had not read anything really about quantum physics yet, let alone anything to do with time travel. But
Jerry
it was like
Zukav, The Seat of the Soul, has a lot of quantum physics. It's an old book. It's from the 90s. There's a whole bunch. We don't know that time travel isn't true.
True. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that, we certainly don't know we're the only people in the universe.
Right.
I mean, that seems illogical. They don't have to look like us, but for one tiny, tiny planet in billions of galaxies to be the only ones with life is kind of ridiculous.
I listened to another podcast recently. They were talking about if aliens could read. And it was like, can you imagine if aliens could make contact with us and they've built like spaceships and whatever to get to us in order to make contact, but somehow they haven't come up with a written language.
There is one. Oh, if you haven't read Connie Willis, The Road, it's hilarious. Okay. And it's about, it starts out just as your normal rom-com. She's going to Roswell, New Mexico, because her best friend is planning to marry another kook and she wants to save her. And this guy is into all of the stuff about ETs. And she's there and they've given her a bridesmaid's dress that's that alien green. And she goes out to her friend's car to get some lights to make the museum look less like an alien wedding place. And she's kidnapped by an alien who looks like a tumbleweed and who does not have language. But he can whip things around with those tumbleweed arms. And it is such a funny book. And she ends up on the alien side. It's really well. I had never heard of Connie Willis. She is apparently a grandmaster of science fiction. Now I have to read more. But The Road to Roswell, guys, so good. But in exploring the ET, she came up with all of this. She had one guy that was the alien kidnapped in the car with her. And he knows all the theories and all the reasons that aliens do these things. And they're all bullshit. I see my friend Pam Dumond, who is a wonderful writer, just got on here.
Yeah.
Hi, Pam.
She said, love you, Sue Berger. Good job.
We are both members of the, or were both members of the Romance Writers of America a Los Angeles chapter, and Pam has just moved out of state to North Carolina, but uh-huh. she's written some amazing books, and one of them, Pam, what was the movie that you caused?
That you caused. What a way to put it.
It's a well-known movie, but she did the research and got the person.
Okay. Trey is near North Carolina, so that's an interesting.
She's got a bunch of good books out. She's got a series that has the Annie Grace series. And then there's a series with Kat that is a detective. And then there's a futuristic series and a time travel series.
She hasn't answered yet, but Sandra said Carolina Romance Writer is a chapter in Charlotte, or at least it was.
Oh, yeah, she's part of that, and she's part of Sisters in Crime and things like that.
Okay.
That's awesome. Well, Pam, if you happen to be in the Charlotte area, just let me know, because I actually live around that area. But I would love to make a connection sometime. Susan, I love one that we can talk about science fiction with you, this in depth, and it's clear that it's like one of the things that inspires your books. What are some other inspirations that you have when it comes to writing?
Well, when it came to romance writing, I never thought I'd do a thing like that.
Yeah.
But there's a thing which is happening now called NaNoWriMo. You probably know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
November is National Write a Novel Month.
Okay.
Yeah.
And somebody told me about it. And up until that point, I had the longest thing I'd ever written was 16,000 words. It's a mid-grade novel that's never been published. And I had to try it just to see if I could do it. And the romance, the whole thing came out of that. I started writing and it turned into a romance. And it came from an idea. Once in my life, a long time ago, I kissed a stranger on a subway. And we were just, and it's in the book, I used the scene, but we were on a subway and it was hot, it was crowded, and we were packed in like hogs for slaughter. And they opened the door and another few people walked in. And this guy was looking at, we were both shaking our heads, and then we both started laughing. And it ended it being a kiss.
Wow.
And we did not, you know, he said, what's your name? And I said, and he said, where can I find you? And I said, no, let's leave the magic. And I didn't follow up on it. So in the book, she followed up on it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's so cool.
What a cool, wow, that's so awesome.
And then the other books came from that. And, but characters just come into your head. And it's so funny because my next book, maybe this time, I went to a California Dreaming workshop with a person who had a workshop on writing a book on a week. I thought, this is awesome. If I could write a book in a week, that would be so amazing.
Yeah.
And my friend lent me his house in Ventura because he was going away. I was all by myself, just me and the laptop. And I didn't have to answer to anybody or do anything. And I got up in the morning and I started and I stopped for a walk on the beach, did a little yoga. I started at 9 in the morning and stopped at 1 in the evening. And I had 6,000 words. Now, if you magnify that by 7, that is not a book.
No.
No, that's not going to be a book. And that was my best day. But I did get a book in 3 weeks. And I started out with the my heroine is the sister of the hero in the first book. And it was mentioned in the first book that she'd been married 3 times and that the 3rd time was lucky. So I started with that. What I didn't realize is that the 3rd time was to her first husband that she remarried. And I could not figure out until I walked on the beach what was going to happen next. my mind would not tell me.
Sure.
I find that very annoying. Do you guys write? Does that happen to you? Or
you got to step away.
And yeah, like, your mind just won't tell you.
Yeah.
You can sit there as long as you want, but it's not going to tell you one thing.
Yeah, I have that going on. Well, right now for an idea I have that. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Nano helps you with that because
okay,
you need a word count. You need about 2,500 words a day if you're going to take off weekends and Thanksgiving in November. And therefore, you write something and you think, oh my God, that is terrible. I can never use this. This is ridiculous. But it's word count. Keep writing.
Right.
And you write through the crap. And eventually you end up with stuff you can use. It's a first draft you're going to get.
Yeah.
Well, it's nothing but a first draft. It's not really showable to anybody.
Right. But at least it's out there.
Yeah.
And so George R. R. Martin, if you're listening, I want you to go to NaNoWriMo.org. I'm glad you got that.
Look, huh?
I mean something.
Well, you look at Jen Cruzy, Jennifer Cruzy. She had a writer's block for 12 years.
Yes. And that story is amazing. And
believe me, I was there waiting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
With everybody else who follows ARG Inc. waiting for that book.
Mm-hmm.
And also for another one she hasn't got out yet, The Devil and Nita Dodd. But I know it's going to come out.
Well, and there was, if you saw the show that she was on, she talks about how many books she has that aren't published that she's started mm-hmm. or is somehow in. And she sent several to Bob. And it sounds like Bob, he announced it on our show that he had finished or pretty much finished this one. And hadn't told her yet, and it was really cool news.
Yeah, and she, I think, has been through that now. But he's on the second book, and is it's funny reading their blog, reading her blog, because sometimes she'll put the text exchanges between them up there.
Yeah, yeah, it's fabulous.
Very crazy.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're what a mind blowing relationship they have with each other.
No.
They hadn't seen each other for years until the show, and we didn't know that. We didn't know what we were getting into, but it turned out to be so great. It was, yeah, quite the dynamic duo, Josh said. That is accurate. Yeah. In fact, I think we were recommended to have you on the show by Jenny Cruzy.
She did. And I couldn't believe that. And I said, but you know, both at right about that time, I got something from AARP magazine asking if they could put Time and Forever on their list of books, sexy reads for the winter.
Awesome.
And she said, yeah, I got one of those. And I said, yeah, but you're famous. And she looked at, you know, she wrote back, you're famous. I thought, no, I'm not.
It's one of those things of like the people that we look up to and we're like, okay, one, you know who I am. And then two, you're like, oh, you're recommending me for things.
I know. That's just amazing.
It's, yeah. Thinking through some of the guests that we have, that we've had on the show even recently, like I have to say that 2023 has been like a year for us on the podcast to have some incredible individuals. You are definitely one of them that, especially with some of the just coincidences that we found just on this episode. But it's crazy to look back and just go, wow, it really is such a small world. And then you go, we really are just like human people. Getting to talk to them that they are incredible individuals who are artistic and absolutely deserve the praise that they have. But it's also so nice to see them just be human.
Yeah.
And just be themselves.
Yeah. Because we're all artists somehow.
Absolutely. And the funny thing, I have seen a lot of people get famous, you know.
Sure.
Barry was in Northern Exposure, and that was a huge, huge hit TV series. And the only person who went before that The only recognizable face was Barry. My husband's name is Barry Corbin, and okay. they list his birthday and stuff in October. He's on everything. But I saw so many people not be able to deal or have difficulty when they're told, oh, now I'm a big thing. And it can, as his friend G.W. Bailey, who's one of the leads in The Closer, G.W. said, you know, they can get a touch of the big head. I've seen a lot of people get a touch of the big head, but most of them don't. They're just amazing, fun people. And it's easy, though. I have to say, when people start telling you how great you are, it can be easy to forget that everybody else is just as great.
Yeah.
You just got noticed. And that's nice. But it doesn't mean everybody has an amazing story.
It does. Yeah.
And everybody's worth looking and watching.
Absolutely. Yeah, we believe that here too.
Very much so.
Yeah.
You know, if you haven't been discovered yet, so what? That doesn't make you any less valuable. Do you know that Jack London had a 601 rejections, I think, before he sold?
Wow.
Now that's somebody with persistence.
Yeah, you'd think someone might consider giving up. But he must have really,
Dr. Seuss, mm-hmm. 31 rejections before the 32nd person wanted to publish it. And now, of course, they're trying to take it off the market to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which I happen to love. But there's so many people with those stories, so many rejections. And it doesn't mean you didn't do something good, and whether it's your job or whatever.
I belong to a group on Facebook. I won't name the name of it, but it's a group of like classical singers who we go through this big audition season from probably about, I would say about October through about March-ish. That's when the normal like contracts are being handed out, et cetera, et cetera. And they refer to the rejection letters as PFOs. Please use your imagination. I will not announce what that stands for on this podcast.
I know what it stands for.
But
I can figure it out.
But the one thing that I can look at this group and say that it's with such certainty that it's a positive force is to look at people and saying, okay, well, it's PFO season. Everybody, announce what you've received PFOs from. And turn it from being a like a negative thing into almost a humorous sort of thing, and look at it as a learning experience to say, oh, you know what? Okay, cool. It's a limited. It's a very like specific field. Like, why not have a little bit of fun with it?
Absolutely.
They do the same thing for the Minnesota State Fair for the photography, because I'm in a photography group for that, and it's and they'll post their picture that is phenomenal. They'll post pictures that are just drop dead gorgeous and be like, yep, this one was rejected. And they all laugh about it. Because it's what can you do?
Who is it? Van Gogh.
Yeah.
Well, only one painting in his lifetime.
Yeah.
Did that mean he wasn't good? I don't think so.
Right.
Okay. So the big trick is trying to believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Say, I have a gift. Who is it? Agnes DeMille or somebody said, you were given a gift and it isn't your business to decide whether it's good or bad or right or wrong. Your business is to give it. And that's it.
That's, yeah.
And I didn't say it right, but that's the general idea.
It's good. Yeah, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. You said it in Susan style, and that's what matters.
Yes.
So for you, when you step away, when you go to, you push everything out. You go into your corner or wherever you go to read, you sit down, you open, you pull a book off the shelf, and you open, it's your favorite book. What is that book?
Not possible. I'm a bookaholic.
Good answer.
I'm sorry. Over here are my Wizard of Oz. All over here, my Susan Elizabeth Phillips, my Jude Devereaux, my Jane Ann Krentz has too many shelves to be. The Time Travel in Curland. I have so many favorite books. Like Susan Elizabeth Phillips has one named Natural Born Charmer that I have given away so many times. It's a joke. And then I just read The Ill-Mannered Benevolent Society. It's a wonderful book. Great. I've completely lost the name of it. Let me see if I can pull it up on the other computer. It's Ill-Mannered Ladies Benevolent Society or something. And it is a Regency book, and it's obviously book one, and it's getting lots. Oh, forget that. Chemistry of Love. Lessons in Chemistry.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. That has just become a series on Apple, and I started watching it, and I was blown away. I'd already read the book, and the book was wonderful. The series is amazing. And then I looked at who wrote it and produced it, and it's a guy named Lee Eisenberg. And as a matter of fact, he produced Jury Duty.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
And so I immediately wrote him a fan letter. And he says it's really thrilling to hear that people like it, but it's brilliant. Do you find that you read a book and you just don't want to stop?
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
I hate the back cover.
And and I will reread. Georgette Heyer is a Regency novel writer who inspired so many people. And she's amazing. And I reread a couple of hers all the time. I've started putting books I've read on my Kindle, like Robert Heinlein. If just in case I don't want to go to my bookshelf, I can just pull it on my phone, which is nice.
That's awesome.
And of course, Jennifer Cruzy and Bob Mayer, that series. I can't wait for the next series.
Right.
And she has one that I just adore called Faking It. And it's about a family who forges paintings.
Oh, neat.
And it is just so funny. But this is a generational family forging paintings.
Wow.
That was so much fun. And again, I've given it away so many times, I'm not sure I have it at the moment.
Oh, have you read Lord of the Rings?
Of course. It's funny. My brother, I have a younger brother, or had a younger brother, and we're 2.5 years apart. And our deal was that we had to read each other's books. So he read all the Nancy Drews, and I read all the Tom Swifts and the Hardy Boys.
Awesome.
And he had a really good reading list, including The Once and Future King in his freshman year at boarding school. But he, when he married, would not marry his wife till she finished the Tolkien trilogy.
Good, nice. Good man.
Yeah. I read Hobbit first and hated it, but he made me read the rest of it. And I loved it. I mean, Lord of the Rings is... He also wrote a short story called Leaf by Niggles that was pretty amazing. Hmm. It's L-E-A-F by Niggles, N-I-G-G-L-E-S.
Are you looking it up,
Trey? I think it's about a perfect leaf, but it's a short story.
We'll have to... I haven't read that one. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
And I'm similar to you. I struggled with The Hobbit and didn't love it as much as the rest of the trilogy.
No, I was 12 when I had to read that. I was in boarding school in South Africa, and it was required. And at that point, I was fairy tales and biographies. And The Hobbit didn't do a thing for me.
I can't imagine having that as required, because I didn't have it required, but... Oh, I don't know. I feel like for that
required in the olden days,
right?
There was one called Mill on the Floss.
Hmm.
It's not required anymore, but in the 50s, it was a required English book, and it's horrible.
She does not recommend it.
No, I used to use, if I could get it, the classic comic book instead of the actual book. Red Badge of Courage, I read the comic book.
Yes.
The comic book.
Yeah.
I remember reading the Red Badge of Courage, and I liked parts of it. Like, the first couple of chapters I remember enjoying, but then I slugged through the remainder of it. That was a chore. That and Grapes of Wrath were just chores.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, Steinbeck. It is a classic, I know, but not for me.
No, I did not like it. And on the other hand, I like happy endings. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Some people are that. I know people who love true crime and need that. I need happy endings. And I had a couple of kids' books that there was a series and I loved it. And then at one point she killed off one of the major characters in a kid's book. Who does that kind of thing?
That's cruel. That's really cruel.
And then I get very involved with the characters. So if something happens to them, there was another book called Advice and Consent by Alan Drury, which was about a senator. And it was a very good political thriller, but then he commits suicide. And it took me months to get over that because the person was real to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I felt. I got the audiobook for The Song of Achilles. Let's just say it like this. It is a mostly faithful telling of like the love story between Achilles and, I'm going to mess his name up. Patroclus. I think I butchered that.
Patroclus, I think.
Yes.
Patroclus.
Yes.
Maybe I'm better at spelling than I am at pronunciation.
We'll go with that pronunciation, but it is like, wow. That book is one of those that I can only read about a chapter at a time because of how in-depth it goes into like their psyche, their emotions, etc. And you walk away with like feeling like you are just plastered in molasses.
Yeah, I can't do that.
Mm-mm.
And I won't go to the, I did not see the book that's the one that's out, the movie that's out right now about the atom bomb.
Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer, yeah. Because I already knew about it. My my mother's cousin's first husband was on the Manhattan Project.
Wow.
And for the H-bomb part and killed himself. And I knew about Oppenheimer and I knew about the project. And there's a wonderful children's book called The Bomb. Stephen somebody. And he won all kinds of prizes. These making, stealing and stuff of the world's greatest weapon. And it won all kinds of awards. I mean, so I bought it because I thought I wanted to. And it was really, it reads like a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
The name of it is Bomb. And it's brilliantly written. But it goes into all the people that were trying to steal the secrets and into the Manhattan Project and everything. And I don't want to see a movie about it.
Mm.
Been there, done that. Don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Don't show me those movies. And I'm grateful for anybody who wants to watch them, but it's just not my thing.
Sure.
It's like my kids don't have to read my romances.
No, but everybody else does.
Yes.
If they're not my kid, it's all right.
Right. If they're not your kid.
Susan, I have two last questions that I want to ask. So first, you talked a little bit about like your acting work and what you're currently, what you've worked on most recently, but I want to make sure our listening audience knows of your current projects and upcoming projects. Can you tell us a little bit?
I could if there were any. You have to understand, jury duty came out when they already knew that there was going to be a strike for the writers, and then the actors struck. So there hasn't been any work for. I did a commercial for Nerd Wallet, which will be seeing somewhere, and I'm singing in it.
Okay.
That I did in Vancouver last week, but I have a movie that hasn't come out called The Legend of Cloudy Falls, which was a lot of fun. It was filmed in Canada, and I narrate it, and I'm also in it.
Nice.
And lots of it's funny because I'm on a lot, and they have pictures that, you know, you see me doing things a lot, but it's all voiceover except one scene. And it was so much fun to do. That's still going to come out. I also have a short film, and I did that. There were things that were happening during the strike that you could do if there were certain projects. Commercials are accepted. This was not a commercial strike. It was a TV theatrical strike. So I'm hoping that this is going to mean that we'll be getting work, and that those of us on jury duty who got noticed for jury duty will suddenly be getting jobs, because that would be terrific.
Yeah, it would.
Yes.
For sure.
I pretty much think everybody on that show is amazing. Also, the crew, the cinema, the cinematographers, the writers, the producers, everybody. I know Jake's been working, our director, but he works on a lot of commercials. But I don't know who else has been working.
I mean, it was such a gem, and very clear that there were many hands, very, very many very capable and amazingly talented hands involved with that show. So it seems feasible that everybody stands a really solid chance of a future.
People were real nice on the strike line and said they liked it, and some of them were producers. So
good.
Awesome.
Good. And then as far as your writing?
Well, I have the Maybe This Time was just republished.
Yes.
And is now available on Amazon, and it will be available as a print book. And all three of the books in the series are available at the library for free. And I had a great narrator. I loved her. I have
awesome.
We'll see. I'd like to put out Lord Byron's Daughter next. It's been through its edit.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You can do that.
Yeah, but first I want to find out what happens with Maybe This Time, because that's my first self-publish.
Right. Well, we're going to watch. We're going to watch to see what you do. And I can't wait to see. Yeah.
It'd be really fun if they could figure out a way to make a second season, but
I was wondering.
Yeah.
They'd have to put it somewhere else, and they couldn't use any of us.
Right.
They'd have to find somebody who never saw the show, and that they could probably do, because lots of people haven't seen Jury Duty. My cousins, a lot of my friends, you know, I know lots of people haven't seen Jury Duty. I was in the hospital to get a knee replacement, and nobody there had seen it.
So. Wow. So you're recommending it to everybody, I hope.
Oh, yeah.
And then to make sure that for like content or to stay in touch with you and notices of when your books get published or when you are on the second season of Jury Duty, or whatever future projects you have, where can our listening audience stay in touch with you?
Let's see. I'm on Facebook. And both as an author page, Susan B. James, and as Susan James Berger or Susan J. Berger. Who am
I? It's on Facebook, you're Sue Berger 3, and as an author, you're Susan B. James. Uh-huh. No, I have this wrong. It's Berger Susan James on Instagram. On Facebook, it's Sue Berger 3. And then it's susanbjames.com is website and SusanBergerActor.com.
That's my acting site.
Yeah.
Since I do voiceover, I'm required to have an acting site. That's the only way you get voiceover.
Sure. And then Susan James Berger on TikTok.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I wrote that down somewhere. Oh, look, you put it up there.
Yeah, I did.
I see it.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And when this episode's published, we link all that as well. So people will be able to find you.
All right. Thank you.
Of course.
This has been a pleasure.
You guys, thank you.
Really fun to talk to.
Thank you. You have been great.
I can't believe you're beekeeping. That's amazing. Singing, I understand. Beekeeping, wow.
It's been an adventure.
I'll bet.
Yeah, because I'm new to it still. So I haven't gotten through a whole year yet. But it's an adventure. I started putting the videos on TikTok, and those have been a little popular. It's really fun. They seem to like me so far.
Oh, that's the bees. Great.
Yeah, they get to know you.
Text and you get me to a link.
What's that?
Text me a link to a bee.
I will do that. Okay. Yeah, they get to, you get used to hearing what their different buzzes mean. So you can tell, like, everybody kind of knows what an angry bee sounds like. But, like, there are different buzzes when they're, like, cooling down the hive or when they're stuck in a spot. It sounds different. Wow. You get used to that. And they say that the queen makes sounds that are different, too, but I haven't detected that yet. So we'll see. I'd love to hear that.
We talked about a little bit of that whenever I did, like, a touring kids performance of a bee opera. And there were, like, different dances that they'll do and, like, different sounds that they can make based on the sound of their wings. And that was part of, like, the education for the kids before they came to the opera and watched us do the things. And we would hear them say, like, oh, they're doing that. They're doing that. Oh, they're going to go get pollen.
That's awesome.
So that was fun. Mm-hmm. I am really looking forward to the time that I can come out and visit and you will just take me out to the bee with, like, no protection from the bees and just go pull up one of the, like, the slats and just go, mm-hmm, here are all the bees.
Mm-hmm. I do that. Yeah, you can.
Yes.
I mean, when I'm getting deep into the hive, like where the brood box is, they're very protective over their babies. So I will wear my bee suit to get into the brood box because I don't want to make them so angry that they want to sting me. Because right. One wrong move, it happened one time, and it hurt.
Oh, no.
It did. It hurt. But it was kind of my fault. I messed up. I slipped with the frame, and they didn't like that much. So yeah. I'm learning, like I said, and, you know, I don't want to hurt any of them. You know what? You know what's funny? The most common question I get about the bees is?
What?
How many do you have?
Really?
And I don't know how to
answer. Anybody know the answer to that?
My own father asked me that. I was like, I don't know how to tell you this, Dad. It's like a couple thousand.
Dear God. That's it.
I don't count them. There's too many.
Wow.
Like 10? I don't know.
How did you get into that?
I've always wanted to. And Josh, who you met before the show, our moderator, he's my boyfriend, and he gifted me with a beehive for Christmas last year, and we got bees in June. We got a colony that's local, because I'm in Minnesota, so we got a colony locally, because bees need to be able to get through the winter here. And
right. Yeah, you're in Minnesota.
So these are hardy bees, and they're honeybees, but they know how to get through a winter here. And I just always wanted to. So he also got me a couple books on beekeeping, which helped a lot. Because I've learned that if you join Facebook groups on beekeeping, you're going to get every answer under the sun on your problems. But I'm getting there. You kind of have to, it's one of those things you have to feel out for yourself, like what's working and what isn't.
Yeah.
And that's something they don't always tell you.
No, I imagine not.
Because every bee...
It's easier to write books.
Maybe. Maybe it is. Yeah. I mean, you're at least not completely You don't have to feel responsible for thousands of lives.
Yes. I like things where I don't have to feel responsible for thousands. I don't have a dog or a cat.
Yeah.
I mean, I have grandkids, but.
Right. That's different.
But I can go away if I want.
Or you can.
Away.
You can tell them how to bake you something too.
Right. Yes.
Bake a cake. That's wonderful.
Oh gosh. Well, Susan, you are such a multifaceted person, and it has honestly been such a joy to have you.
Yes.
And it is so nice to meet the woman who made me slightly terrified, but also, which was amazing to find out that you had written a book that's in my mom's house.
That's so cool.
And
say hi to your mom for me.
I will. I got to talk to an author of one of our books. And I mean, just to be just such a fun person in general to talk to. It is really nice to have this time with you here.
Well, thank you. You guys are great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being real with us. And I hope you come back and hang out with us again sometime.
Oh, I'd love it. I'll do something and then you'll want me back.
Yeah.
Different.
Yes.
Okay. That would be fun.
Absolutely.
We'll have all kinds of fun.
Well,
you're the kids.
Well, as we close out this episode here, this episode, along with probably every episode, will always be in memory of Joe Capone, our moderator, fellow comedian, passionate encourager, and greatly missed friend. You can find us pretty much wherever you tune into podcasts. For updates, announcements, and more, please follow us on social media under Modern Romantic. Thank you, everybody, and have a buzzworthy day.
Oh, boy.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, my gosh, Emily, I cannot believe this incredible chocolate we've been tasting. Oh, we had to bring Eric and Jaleesa from Storyboard Delights back to discuss.
Absolutely, we did. What is it about your chocolate that makes it so magical?
Ooh, it's magical because we infuse so much fun in our chocolate. It's not something serious, but it is a serious experience. We make sculpted chocolate bars that have stories to tell, like, for instance, our Red Riding Hood bar.
Oh, the Red Riding Hood bar is super fun. First, we start with the digital painting on the front, and it tells the first part of the story of Red Riding Hood walking into the woods. And then when you unwrap it, you have this sculpted bar of Big Bad Wolf sitting in Granny's bed. And then you taste it, and the flavor profile wraps up the rest of the story. And so you first, when you bite into it, you taste the earthiness of the chocolate, which is the hunting grounds of the Big Bad Wolf. And then you've got the pasilla chili pepper, which provides sort of the prowl. It's kind of spicy, not quite, but then the guajillo bites you at the end, just like the Big Bad Wolf.
You can find us at www.storyboarddelights.com. Pick out whichever chocolate you want, whichever story you want, and we will ship it right to your door.
Fantastic. I'm going to storyboarddelights.com right now.